What's up, everybody? It's Keith from the Stream Team, the number one movie podcast for all things streaming. I'm your host, and with me, as always, Chris Lauer and Cole Miller. And today, we're going to go back a little ways, 1992, the first. This is the first, right, of his 10, 9, 10, 11 movie run. Quentin Tarantino, is this his first one?
Yes, I mean,
I'm sure he had some, like, some college projects or something, but as far as his first major deal, this guy came out 1992, Reservoir Dogs. The word cult classic gets thrown around a lot with movies, and sometimes people say it just for a movie that they like that's crappy, and people want to call it a cult classic because, like, not everybody likes it, man, but it's awesome. It's just like, no, it's just a bad movie that you like. This is a
this is it.
This, when people talk about that particular genre of movies, a movie that did, it had a $1.2 million budget. This movie did almost $3 million. This is a movie that you could ask a lot of people about, and a lot of people have seen this movie multiple times on end as far as Reservoir Dogs go. I mean, it's, this movie's an hour 40 minutes, and it feels right. Like, with it's odd because it feels like it runs longer because there's just so much content in it, but it doesn't feel like it drags, if that makes sense. But there's
it is like so crisp, fast, like it doesn't feel like a long movie
at all.
It's, you know, you're kind of being held on, but every scene feels integral to the movie. Even like the more mundane ones don't feel mundane at all, especially when you're watching it. I think that that's one of the, you know, to what you're talking about, Keith, that's a testament to how great this movie is and like why it is a cult classic, because every part of it feels so fucking important.
Every single piece I've watched, I enjoy going back. I enjoy this pod for a myriad of reasons. Obviously, I like chopping it up with you two about movies because it's just good to talk movies with people who enjoy movies and not just like, I like to go see a movie. It's like, no, we genuinely enjoy all things movie making, but doing this pod, it allows me to do a lot of things. Usually I watch a movie twice, at least, whenever we do it. One for research and one just to watch it because something fell through the cracks during said research. And so watching a movie like this that I've seen several times already, I get to go back and watch, and I'm like, oh, wait, I missed that. When did this part happen? When did this scene come in? And it's obviously been a scene that's been in the movie the entire time, and I just missed it or glossed over it or would always get up to go fix a snack or something during that particular scene. So watching a movie like this and just seeing, I don't know that there's a wasted line or scene or anything in this movie. You know, I mean, it's like I said, with it being an hour and 40 minutes, I don't think that this movie can afford that. And it's just done so well. Chris, you know, seeing this early in Tarantino's career and knowing that this is how his movies would go about, right? Like the nonlinear storytelling and all those things. It's like, you know, a major league ball player, it's like watching their high school highlights or something where it's like, man, this guy's going to be big. It's like, this guy, how interesting is it to see this particular movie having seen the rest of Tarantino's work?
It works out kind of perfect that you've given me this question, because I imagine it's probably the case with most people, but I saw a lot of his like middle to more recent stuff before I saw this. I don't want to say this is the last Tarantino that I got around to, because I mean, I certainly saw, like, you know, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and stuff like that a bit more recent, but you know, this was on my latter, you know, half of getting around to all of his stuff, and it is just that exact kind of thing, like to see some of this stuff, like, you know, the middle of his career and some of his latest stuff, and to go back and watch this, it is just like seeing, you know, Zion when he was running around with all the kids.
Yeah,
he was running around with the kids who were like, we're going to be playing soccer in 2 years or something. Like, it's like watching this guy who you just like, yeah, that's definitely his game. And so much of what makes him so interesting, and so many of the techniques and things that he does that just makes all sorts of people love him. Like, it's just interesting to see it there. You know what I mean? Like, you would maybe think when you go back to some stuff like that, especially on like writing, you would think like, oh, you know, it was probably way different back then. He maybe wasn't as strong a writer. Maybe he didn't do certain things. Certainly, maybe he didn't structure stories, or maybe he didn't build characters a certain way. And then you watch this and you're just like, no, actually, this is how he makes movies. And he's just very good. And he's just always been good. Like, obviously, you know, characters in this movie and characters in Inglourious Basterds and characters in Django are different. But, you know, a lot of the ways that he likes to write them, it's just so similar. Like, it's so similar, but it's so different. Like, if I didn't know this, like, Quentin Tarantino movie and someone just showed it to me after seeing the rest of his work, I would be like, obviously I'd fucking see him like at the table and be like, that's odd. But at some point I'd be like, did he make
right.
this?
Yeah. Right.
Tarantino makes this movie. So, I mean, it is exactly that. If, you know, you see all of his more recent stuff and you just see what he's just grown into, you know, being a guy who does make, you know, some of these bigger films, but they all still have this same kind of like intimate, close, personal, like relatable is the wrong word, but I'm sure there's something like that kind of essence to him that this movie that he made for, you know, $1 million has, and it still has the same feel as the movie that he made that probably cost, you know, 75 plus with Brad and
right.
Leo
right.
and all those kind of guys. So
no,
it's an odd one.
I just kind of marvel at that to be able to pull off a project like this. I mean, Cole, we talk about a $1 million budget of a movie. I mean, the budget was so low that they couldn't even get traffic control in this movie. Like the scene where Buscemi
right.
carjacked that lady, the only way they could get that scene pulled off was because the light was green. Like that's
yeah, carjack right. a real woman.
You're right. Yes.
That was an actual, I had to explain it to her later.
The lady who shot Tim Roth actually shot him. He's actually dead.
Yeah, like he's actually dead now. Yeah, yeah. It's like, damn, that's why we haven't seen him anything.
Yeah, right. It's like the person who was supposed to be his twin brother, Tom Roth or something.
Yeah.
So much sense now. I get it. But being able to pull off a project like this called a movie with a Rotten Tomato score of 1994, small budget. You know, obviously he's recycled a lot of these actors in all of his movies. Clearly, Michael Madsen being, you know, Michael Madsen, Tim Roth, and obviously himself with others as well. He had Harvey Keitel in Pulp Fiction. But man, to pull off something like this with that and to see where his career has blossomed, it's pretty awesome to see.
Yeah, and I think the most fun thing about it is like a lot of the directors that we see today and the ones that we love don't really get an opportunity to just claw their way into making a movie like this and then mm-hmm. be able to show us really what they got going on, right? Because like there are a few guys like Quentin Tarantino, of course, we've done what feels like five of his movies now, mm-hmm. but he's one of those guys that can do it with a good big budget. He can do it with a small budget, right? Like it doesn't really matter. And it's pretty great that he's able to make the movies the way he wants to now and spare no expense and get the top talent and all that sort of stuff. But when you really strip it down to its bones, Reservoir Dogs is a movie of something that shouldn't happen, but he's able to turn it into one of those movies that people will rank in their top 20 right. and still to this day and kind of spawned a whole new culture of movies. And just being able to do that, like you said, Keith, and not spend a shitload of money. I mean, there were people that had to bring their own wardrobe just to make this movie work, right? There was no heist shown in this movie. Everything was just so bizarre and shouldn't actually work. But it does because it's Quentin Tarantino doing his thing. And I think that the movie that he makes that I feel was closest to this would be Hateful Eight, right? And because and not just because it's like set in one place or whatever, what have you, but the eerie kind of mood as well. But it really is him just showing off at a certain point. And and I love this movie. Not because I think it's particularly that much better than his other stuff. I don't even know if I would put it in his, you know, best works personally. But what I love about it is you just see him doing his thing and a guy figuring out how to make the best possible movie out of something that just shouldn't work.
And it does really well. I mean, we talk about a heist movie that doesn't show a heist at all, like you're talking about.
Right.
It's literally just all events around it before, during, and after. Sorry, Chris, let me cut you off.
No. You're responding to calls. Going to go back on it. I was going to say, I wonder if, and I guess wonder is the wrong way to go about it. When you're saying like it's just crazy what he's able to do with practically no budget, right? I mean, $1 million is still a lot of money. I feel like that has so much to do with the fact that he, as everyone knows, like didn't go to film school, didn't do all the conventional routes, so he had to kind of learn how to do this kind of stuff like outside of the normal way, you know, because I wonder if someone who went the film school route is given $1 million and is told to make this movie, like they probably have no fucking idea. They're probably like, oh, that's not possible at all, actually. Like, you know, the conventions that people probably go, I'm sure there's someone out there who could make the movie, would it be this good? Probably not. But you know, I feel like so many of the conventions that people probably take and what they learn would just make it impossible to look at like the resources or lack thereof and to create this you know, good and this entertaining, this fun of a story on, you know, $1 million, you know. So it's like, I do think that a lot of his early stuff that he makes a lot out of a little just has a lot to do with the fact that, again, he went about it differently. Like, he doesn't go the conventional method because he just didn't learn them in the same way. It's like, that's always one of those things I've always been like impressed with and like just loved about Tarantino. Like, when you look at how he's able to pull this stuff off, I'm like, you can only do if you don't know how to do it, you know?
Right. Like, it is, you know, somebody who teaches themselves how to cook or play an instrument or something, where it's like, it's not the traditional route, and it comes off, it may come off as quirky, you know. It's like almost like listening to, you know, the first time somebody listened to jazz, right? It's like, this isn't the traditional way a song should go, but then people are like, wait, I actually kind of love this and this is great. And his storytelling type has been, I mean, copied a million times over. I mean, it feels like watching this movie, I'm like, man, this feels like watching this. I mean, honestly, just like, you know, obviously the score soundtrack is huge for him in a lot of his movies, but it feels like we're watching Guardians of the Galaxy, because anytime something big is happening in a particular scene, or we have a transition from one scene to the other, there's a big song that happens, right? You know, there's a big shift in the music or score or whatever, and it's like, okay, this is going to be a pivotal point, or we're going to another scene that we really need to pay attention to. And it's just awesome that this is something that is clearly, again, just somebody who enjoys making movies. And, you know, this, you know, it would just be like watching a movie by one of us. You know, it's like, man, this is just all the things in a movie that I enjoy. And so here, like, watch this particular thing and enjoy it, because it's like, yeah, all the things that we gush over here is we're going to make sure is going to be in this particular film, short or whatever. And it's going to be great. But when was the last time y'all watched a heist movie that didn't actually showcase the heist?
Yeah, I mean, they're like, I'm sure there is an example, but I can't think of
it. I can't think of it. Because when you make these, like, that is like, that's the central part. That's the thing that they think everyone cares about, like that, like, which in most movies, and that's the focus, they are typically usually like really cool. But, you know, those are the ones that like this 5 to 15 minute sequence of people just robbing this bank is going to be draw you in with. So it's like, I can't think of another example either. And, you know, like you guys said, this one just doesn't have one, and it just still rules. Like, it feels like you still watch, it's like so fun and entertaining that like you kind of forget that you didn't see a heist until like 2 days later, you're like, wait a minute.
wait a fucking minute.
I didn't even see the heist.
Actually, I have the answer for us, Keith. The last time that we watched it was whenever we did Goodfellas, because they don't show the Lufthansa heist.
Lufthansa heist is that's true. It's just the aftermath.
It's not shown at all. It's kind of like this.
Ray Liotta in the shower being excited because he hears about the heist on the radio. Yeah, so that's a good shout. Yeah, there it is right there. Boom. Ask and you shall receive. That's how we do this pod here.
That's it.
But it is. I mean, that just showcases how rich the story and the storytelling is, that we don't even, this is a movie about a heist. It doesn't show the heist, and yet we are still fully entertained. Again, 90 to 94 is a very high score. One of the highest scores that we've gotten on both sides in a couple of movies. I know we just did one recently that had a really high score, and I'm blanking right now on what it was. But as far as everybody in it,
Top Gun Maverick was high as fuck.
That was high as fuck.
She was like 97, 99.
It was higher than the fucking airplanes, dude.
Seriously, though. But to have a movie like that not showcase the heist, and it's just, dude, it's just awesome. And what I also marveled at is how, as we got, I don't want to say introduced to each character, because we were introduced to them early on, but as we learn more about each character, that's,
man, I was just about to fucking say this. Is, look at you.
This particular scene, man, would just come up, and then we would get that backstory. Like, oh, go ahead. I know this is something we're going to talk about, all three of us, but just go into how clever that particular storytelling property is, because we get this nonlinear thing, and it was like, wait a second, how do we get to, and then bam, we get that person's story, and then we get that piece at the exact moment we need it. Go ahead and go into that.
Yeah, all I was about to say is that the character building of this movie is fucking unreal, man. Dude, especially like every character, at least the main ones that you end up having some sort of like, you know, conversation with or any of that sort of stuff, all of them have so much character built in such a short period of time. There have been people who have made full fucking Batman movies and not be able to tell and build characters like this movie builds characters. And we already know the backstory of fucking Batman. Right. So it's like it just shows his cleverness and how good he is at knowing every single thing we need to know about all of these characters with just these small interactions. And he does that in a smart way, right? Like we learn from Mr. Blonde, he just got out of prison, but we also learned he was a bit of a wild card because he just started talking shit to that guy as soon as he walked in and they were all started wrestling. So we automatically were like, oh yeah, Mr. Blonde would shoot a bunch of people. That isn't an unbelievable thing. And Harvey Keitel's character, Mr. White, the way his smoothness, his calmness, everything about him, it just is, you know, it's one of those things that, and I think Chris put it perfectly, like most filmmakers wouldn't do because they were told how to do things. And it wasn't like that. But Quentin Tarantino isn't like that. He was like, I'm going to build characters the way I want to, and I'm going to go out of fucking order because I can. And then you're going to rewatch the movie and you're going to understand it again. And then you're going to rewatch it again and you're going to understand it even more because that's what he does best.
Right. Having somebody who goes off script because he never had the script is perfect to be able to do that, because somebody who did have
the script, read me.
Like going off script and having the script is going to feel like that, because it's like, oh, this is on purpose. This isn't actually, not to say that Tarantino wasn't doing this purposefully, because he was, but he felt like this is a better storytelling method. And so that's how we got it. And it worked out really well. I mean, like every time we got to a point, I'm like, where did this particular point come from? Then bam, it's like, oh, that's where it is. And then we get Mr. Orange's backstory or Mr. White's story, or like you're talking about, Cole, we get Blonde's story. Then it's like, oh, this is where all the pieces fit in. It's like putting a puzzle together. I won't even say backward, just like starting from the middle and working out or something. And it works out. Chris, I'd let you talk about this storytelling method too, because this is something that not a lot of directors can pull off in a meaningful way, where the story makes better sense to be able to be told this way.
It does. And it's one of those things where it's like, it works well with the pacing, because he doesn't cut to these like character scenes. And it's like them from like the moment they were born up until like, it's like relatively close to the heist, but it's like, it's just far back enough. And it's them in just like the perfect situation to get a complete look at who they are as a person. Like you're saying, when Blonde goes into the meeting, he starts wrestling with the guy, right? So it's right. Like that gives you everything you really need to know about his personality. You know, he's cracking jokes, he's being a bit of an asshole. So it's just like, to just do that, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to take this maybe what, for most of them, just like a couple of minutes for something that happened not too long ago story-wise, and create this scene that's going to tell you everything you need to know about this character. And then I'm going to send you back into the story and you'll be perfectly caught up. You'll feel like you wrote it with me. It's just like, it's just phenomenal, because like Cole said, people make movies for characters who we know the lore of, and they don't do as good of a job as this. And if they come close, they have to start like when they were a sperm, right? They have to like go back so far and tell you every single moment of this person's life to get you like to understand enough about the character that, you know, Tarantino does with something that happened with them sitting across from a guy having a conversation, you know, 2 weeks or something before the actual heist. So that's just like another thing that's just, it's just, it, you, I can't even think of the word. Like, it's just, he's just that good a writer. He just came out of the game. He was like, yeah, give me Harvey Keitel and I'm gonna make this movie real quick, and I'll like do all this great character work, and I'll still keep it under 2 hours. And damn it, he did
well
it.
Well under 2 hours.
How?
It was well under 2 hours, and we were fed perfectly. It was crazy, because whenever I was going to start typing up my notes and I got to the runtime category of it, I was like, oh yeah, this is at least 2 hours, like 2:10. And I got to it, and I was like, wait, an hour 40?
Right.
Like this movie just felt like, it felt like it was so much
longer. I have time to take my shoes off.
Seriously. Like, and again, it doesn't feel like it's so long because it just dragged. It felt like it's so long because we just got so much protein. It's like, dude, it's like eating a Quest cookie. It's like, wait, this has 12 grams of protein? What are you talking about, man?
I was like, yeah, right. Like, where does that even come from?
It opens with the entire crew at this diner talking about like the background behind the song, like a
version. Yeah, let's just go ahead and say this is the laugh out loud scene and move on.
Yeah.
So
it's like the closest one. It's mine.
I will be.
This is the funniest shit on planet Earth, Keith. Like they're just
it is six
grown men sitting around a table talking about like a virgin.
He's a dick.
I got dicks over here in my ear. I got your book. You're reading your fucking book. And then they go into this whole like tipping fucking dissertation for no reason, man. That's the funniest shit
whatsoever. But
only he could do some shit like that too. Like that was like. That's one of the moments where I'm like, did Quentin Tarantino make this movie? Like, if you just bash me over the head, and like, all I knew is that like Quentin Tarantino has made like a movie before, and I don't remember my name or anything else. If I just like knew that, and then I watched this, like when the bleeding stopped, I'd be like, hey, did that Quentin Tarantino guy make this movie?
Right.
Also, I think I'm bleeding out my chest.
Not that you mentioned it. Bleeding out my chest. But right, like it opens like that, and then we get the whole tipping situation. It's like, what the fuck's going on with this movie? And then we get the opening credits, and then the very next thing that happens is we get wailing from the backseat from Mr. Orange, and Mr. White is driving them to the fallback spot, and we have Orange bleeding all over this lady's or this car, the backseat of this car, and we're just like, wait, did he get shot at the heist? Like, what's going on? What's happening here? And so there's 400 questions being asked because we're like, wait, how do we even get to this point? And then the story is told to us. Just Chris, like opening a movie like that is insane, isn't it?
It is, right? Because, you know, again, we're talking about this like fun scene. We don't know too much about, you know, how much they know each other, what their relationships are like. We just know that, you know, they're about to pull off a heist. We see all these guys dressed pretty sharp. We're enjoying that. Then we get like the character intros, or I guess the title and like the character, I'm blank. I don't know what I'm trying to say. But you guys know what I'm getting at, right? We get the title and then
the opening credits.
Like, Jesus, yeah. My brain is all over. I'm sorry. We get the title and the credits, and then it, you know, like I said, it just cuts to Tim Roth just dying in the back of a car, and you know, it just throws you right in, and like it doesn't do the thing where it's just like. It immediately takes you back and shows your thing. It just like doesn't tell you what happened. You just feel like the next hour and they're just like, yeah, you'll find out at some point, but just not right.
Right.
Now. And right. It just, you know, picks up the story from this super gripping, like exciting question asking part to just carry you through. And it's just like said it before and I'll say it again, nobody else would do that. Take like the best director that we know and like give them this same concept and have them make that movie back then. They just wouldn't have made it that way. They would have, you know, they would have found a way to squeak the heist in or do something, you know, show some kind of stuff prior to that, right? But he just straight up throws, you know, like, yeah,
gotta do something out there.
We gotta do something.
Yeah, you gotta do something.
Tim Roth, stop bleeding in the back of my car. I'm not gonna eat your lunch.
I gotta eat your lunch. I don't give a fuck.
You gotta get shot big.
Get shot big.
Get shot with a shotgun. I don't care.
I can't believe football season's almost over. We filmed that right before it started. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's wild.
It was like last week.
Yeah. I know, dude.
Makes me sick.
Oh, time is not real. But yeah, it's just one of those crazy that like you're so blown away about it because you're just like, this is the only timeline and only possible way when this would be made this way because it had to be made by this person. And it's just so different from, you know, other films and like other ways that people would make again this same exact movie.
No, it doesn't make any sense, but it makes the most sense. It's crazy. It's such a unique way of telling a story. And I eat it up because it's like, I'm ready to, I don't know what's going on here, but I'm ready to have it explained to me. But it's not just like an explanation. We're not just being spoon fed this. It's in the scene. It's within the scene. Like we get, everybody has their own title. We have the white, we have blonde, we have nice guy Eddie. Like everybody's introduced. And in the way that tells us why that scene that just happened like it did, mm-hmm. And then we get the explanation, or then it keeps the audience right where we need to be, and I think that that's just a brilliant way to tell a story because it's like we're being manipulated by the story. We're not just watching it like, oh yeah, this is about to happen, and it's just like, wait a second, who's the cop again, Mr. White's what, Mr. Orange?
Yeah.
I also have a category that I would like to propose as we get into the categories because I have some questions about this particular guy, but we will get there.
Oh, no. No, what the fuck was wrong with that guy award?
It's pretty, actually, it's really, it's funny that you say that because that's almost exactly what the It's not quite that, but it is. Okay, so it's what's the purpose of this guy award? What is this guy, particular guy, do? But if I said that Harvey Keitel carried this movie, would I be crazy to say that?
Not even close. You're 100% correct.
It's Harvey Keitel, man.
This is the Harvey Keitel movie, right? Like, this movie
shows features. So much in this movie. Like, in obviously he's the guy. Like, he's, especially at this time period, there weren't people that just brought it every movie like he did. Mm-hmm. And you know, he's obviously been a big Tarantino guy since the very beginning. I mean, he was in From Dusk Till Dawn with him. You know, like he's just kind of been his guy. But yeah, man, he's the reason this movie works. I'm sure there could have been somebody else that was put in it or whatever, but he shows so much emotion throughout this whole fucking movie. And so like his range through this is crazy.
It's off the charts. Like he, when they get back to the hideout spot and he's trying to calm down Pink.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't know, just like a masterclass in acting. Like as he's talking to Pink and he's like, "Here, man, have a cigarette," and he's just combing his hair in the mirror and he's just trying to act normally, even though there's nothing normal about this scene. Like,
you know,
like
orange guy's dying, actually.
Orange is in the other room bleeding profusely. They have no idea where the rest of this crew is. Like, I mean, that Steve Buscemi walks in there and he's like, "Was that a fucking setup or what?" And it's just like we're off to the races in that particular scene. So yeah, this is the Harvey Keitel show, man. He's carrying this movie. Like I said, the scene where he's trying to not disarm, but calm down Pink in the fallback spot is just great. Like he's giving him a cigarette and he's trying to ask him, you know, like, okay, how did the scene go down and when did the shooting happen? When did the cops show up? And he's like combing his hair in the mirror and he's trying to calm himself down. It's just, I don't know. I just feel like it's just a masterclass. But
the dying scene too. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Him dying when he's like, yeah. He's like, he's a good kid, man, and like gets shot, and then he's just like crying and shit, man. That shit, he had it, man.
He really did. Well, and it was fascinating to see him do like to see him realize in like real time that he was wrong, and you know, because you could tell he was a guy who hadn't been wrong much about many people. And so when he really felt like Orange was on the up and up, and then he finds out that he's the rat, and then the cops show up. Cause like, so he, at the end, he shoots Orange before he gets shot by the cops. Right. Like that's what that first gunshot is.
Yeah.
I think so. Yeah.
I think so. That's why the cops shot him 1,000 times.
Yeah.
Because he didn't, when that first bang goes off, he didn't go down. But then after
that, he didn't move or anything. Yeah.
Right. Yes. Yeah. So I think he shoots Orange and then he just gets blown away. But I was like, poor thing about that one cop that blonde guy that I mean, he just got his ear cut off and then he got doused in gasoline and then he thinks he's fine. And then Mr. nice guy Eddie comes in and shoots him.
Shit out of
this cop?
This cop.
He shot the crap out of that guy, man. But I just think that the entire cast, like that, this is a Tarantino cast, and not so much the recycled actors that he uses. But man, he gets the most out of everybody. Like everybody in this movie, when it came to their roles, absolutely cooked. I mean, even down to Randy Brooks, who played Holdaway, who was a guy who. Okay, so I'll just go ahead and tell you, that's my Mr. Mustang. He gave He gave Orange the commode story, which that story was fucking. Dude, that was, I guess, another category. That's my best scene. This just the leading up to commode, like the real remembering and learning.
You got
to
know if there's shit splattered on the bowl.
You need to know every detail. And it's just funny because he called
it kind of soap. If it's the powder that they have in the lunchroom, like that shit was. Only Tarantino, man. Yeah,
it was great. Like I've never been so fascinated about a story in a bathroom. But I mean, like even the way he shot it, the way that Orange is in there telling he's narrating the story in the scene as he's telling this, like in another scene. Like, have we seen anything like that at all, Chris? Like to tell us to have a scene like that where he literally is talking about the scene in the scene, but it's another scene. Like he's a dude. Playing a dude,
another scene. Playing the scene, disguised as another scene.
Like how awesome was that scene? Just leading up to and then the execution of.
It's insane. Like it's insanely cool. It's not one of those things that you would ever predict that you would ever think to see. The thing about Tarantino, and I think this is another one that like exemplifies it, if you describe to me something that he's going to do, I'd like, that's like the craziest shit in the world and it won't work. But then you like see it in a film and you're like, this is the coolest shit I've ever seen. And
it's like, why hasn't anybody tried this?
Yeah. Right. But like, when you just
So nobody's robbed a casino. Oh, it's been done. Okay.
Oh, it's been done.
Pencil neck grabs a lockbox. Sorry, go ahead. Chris. Sorry. Yeah, no. Hey, shot that guy listening with
take my breath away.
Like that guy's running out there with all those chips, cigarette in his mouth, and it's like half ash, half cigarette. And he gets out in the parking lot, they shoot him, like all those chips and dollar bills go through that.
Wow, man.
God, dude, that's a beautifully shot scene. That's incredible. Sorry, Chris. I couldn't.
No, you're good. No, that was the laugh I needed. But no, I was just saying, you know, that
scene. I bet y'all didn't have me singing Take Your Breath Away, Take My Breath Away on your bingo card.
Not on my podcast bingo card, not on my 2023 bingo card. It was nowhere to be.
Yep.
I don't think I've ever said cold and take my breath away in the same sentence before.
There we go.
But, no, it's just, you know, that scene, it's just like incredible. And, you know, again, I guess one of those things, like if I hear it described, just imagine describing that to someone, they'd be like, that's not like the dumbest shit ever. That's not going to work. But then you just show it to them. It's the best thing ever.
It's 5 minutes long, too. That man took that much time of his movie to do that.
To tell a commode story.
To tell a commode story. Yeah. Commode.
Commode is
by the way,
in a weird way, you know, he is kind of a procedural guy, but usually it's like a martial arts story or something like that. But him just like giving you the details and making this feel like a real crime movie when there wasn't a heist in it, like some of the background information, like if you were going undercover, he's absolutely right. You would need to believe your story so well that you would have to know every fucking detail, right, to get away with it. And just like all of the, you know, the rendezvous stuff, the keeping fake names, all that sort of stuff, the kind of stuff that we loved about Sicario, where it was just like it felt authentic. I feel like that is this movie too. And something about like feeling like the movie is realistic makes the movie better.
Mm-hmm. Right, like he, and that's the thing, is like we've been around people who've done, not that we just have a bunch of pothead friends or whatever other kind of friends, but anybody who does drugs on a semi-regular basis always has like a drug story, right, where they tell like, one time, man, and then they go into, and it ends up being the longest fucking story ever, and it's like, how do we even get to this point? And exactly right, like this particular crowd, all these guys at least have one story that they always tell, or something that has all the details about whatever it is, drug use or a bus gone bad or whatever. And so he's exactly right. Like Holdway was like, you need a story to tell and you need all these details about it because these guys are going to grill you on it. And he's absolutely right. And so that's why that scene was incredible, down to every single thing. I mean, it gets so detailed. I was like, damn, dude, how did he get out of that bathroom? I was like, wait, there is something to get out of.
It's not even real.
What are you talking about here? Yeah. He's like, when is he going to spend his totem to make sure if he's dreaming or not? Like,
I said, take your fucking hands off the dashboard.
He's like, he didn't realize how close he came to getting shot. You know what he did? And that's just that, even the details with the cops, right? Like, that's hilarious too, because that's exactly a story a bunch of cops would be doing, standing around talking about how he almost shot a guy who was
with a drug dog in the bathroom.
Right.
Buddy, I will put a fucking hole in you. Funniest shit I've ever heard in my life, actually.
Buddy, I will put a fucking hole in you.
You can't point a gun at someone and say, buddy. That's when I'm like, I think this story is horse shit.
Now you're going to have to shoot me. Yeah. If you call me buddy and have a gun pointed at me, you're going to have to shoot me. And
you're like, sorry, Mr. Rogers, I don't believe you. There's bubbles in that fucking gun, aren't there?
How'd you know my name was Buddy?
I don't know. What was it? Oh, like that joke, dude, that kills me every time, where like it's a guy and it's like a flight attendant. She's like, would you like some headphones? And he's like, how'd you know my name was Phones?
just never not gonna be funny. Every time like I see like a meme, and like every year they find a way like to just update the meme, but it's the same
it's the same template
every time, and it's funny every fucking time. I saw one of them shits with LeBron on a team flight one time, and I said, "What are we doing?" But also, still fucking hilarious.
It hits. I'm telling you, man, it hits every single time. Just it crushes me every time I see where it starts. I'm like, "Oh, what's happening next?" Like, there's a 4-frame meme, and I'm just like, "Oh!" By the time I get to the third one, I already know what's coming, and it crushes me every time, dude. But yeah, it's just it is beautifully done, but it's also weird. It's almost like a relationship building too, especially with between White and Orange, and a couple of guys or a group of guys who their biggest rule was, well, like, don't learn about each other. Don't get in relationship. Don't learn names. Don't learn anything else. Not so much because it's like this person could be killed in this particular job or any other job, but mainly because if somebody gets arrested, they can't, plausible deniability, right? They can't say, right, well, I know about this guy, he's from Milwaukee, or he did this job. Like, it's like, this guy knows where you're from. He knows your specialty. He knows what you look like. He's like, he could pick you out of a lineup if he was a rat, like all these different things. And so it's just, you know, like Pink said the whole time, is like, act like a bunch, you know, act like professionals. You guys, I'm the only one in here acting like a professional. So it's just, it was awesome, man. Like this movie, again, it's for it to be a heist movie and we not get a heist and still be this entertained by it, because there's just so many events leading to finding out, okay, and even knowing that White or Orange was the rat, and then like the grand reveal that everybody realizes that he's the rat. That is the big shot, right, Chris? Like, throughout the course of the movie, we thought it was going to be a heist or a big shootout, which of course there was, you know, some gunfire at the end, but the big thing was the whole crew realizing that Orange was the rat.
Right. Yeah. Like that almost ends up being more of the like central tension and conflict than, you know, a movie like this building up to a heist. I know that's just what you said, but that's like a perfect way to put it. Like another type of movie, like the buildup would be to ultimately doing the heist, you know, in the middle or towards the end of the film. But this is just like building up to the moment where we find out who the rat is, and so much other stuff going on in this movie. Right. You kind of forget that, like, the big issue that they had that was like trying to figure out who the rat was. I mean, like Tim Roth is like laying on like a wheelchair ramp, like dying, but you're just like, but the real question is, who's the rat? Like, yeah, he's bleeding out or whatever. Well, don't worry about that. That's fine. So like that being that reveal that we get in the movie, even after we've kind of found out, because, you know, we've gotten his backstory and all that, it still hits for this just like gigantic scene, because there's still tension, because Mr. White doesn't believe it, you know,
right?
And like everyone else is just like, no, he's clearly like the rat. Even early on, we get those like indications of Mr. Pete's like, well, you know, like if he's a rat, you know, he could pick you out of a lineup in less than an hour, right? He knows where you're from, like you said, right. He knows you're from your specialty, he can pick you out in less than an hour. So to have this movie just does a great job, stuff like that, like to have stuff that we already know. But when it becomes like really apparent, or like really useful and like right in front of us in the film, it's still able to be incredibly tense. I know we're kind of off with the commode story. We know it's this fake made up thing, but even when he's walking in the bathroom, you're still tense and hoping like, oh shit, I hope he doesn't get caught. Even though you're just like, this didn't even really happen. Like he was never there. That dog, this whole thing like isn't real. And so the whole rat part is just like another great example of, you know, we may already know it, but when it comes down to how the characters react, it is just serviced so well by having characters that were just built and kind of presented to us in these incredible ways that, you know, we can see this thing that, again, we know the answer to, but they don't know it. And it's just fun to watch.
It is a lot. And also fun to watch. I will say, like, dialed up, nice guy, Eddie, Chris Penn was arguably the second best in this movie. I don't know, man. It's hard to say. I'm
he
sorry,
was
but
fucking close, man. He was good in this.
He was really close. I will say the scene where Orange, like, they come back after ditching the cars and going to get the stash of diamonds, when he comes back and he sees Blonde dead in the corner, he's asking Orange, you know, what's going on, and Orange told him that he had gone crazy and he's going to kill the cop and burn him alive and all that. And like you said, he's like, oh, this cop, and
this cop,
he shot him.
You thought he fired a fucking bazooka at that dude, man? Yeah, crazy.
He shot that guy hard. But like Cole talking about this scene, and just talk about how nice guy Eddie goes through. He's like, the guy who got nabbed for a job could have rolled on us any time in 4 years and didn't mention
to
our
my
name.
Fucking dad. Yeah, like
yeah. Talk about how awesome Chris Penn was in that particular scene.
And he, in a lot of ways, like through the first part of the movie, he was kind of presented as not necessarily having that dog in him. You know what correct. I mean? Like right. you kind of just thought of him as.
Well, because Blunt was like, if you're going to talk like a bitch, I'm going to treat you like a bitch, right? Like
he said, right. Exactly. And he, even the dad was like, well, I didn't want him to tell you this way, even though he was just joking and all that sort of stuff. He kind of felt like the fuck up son. And in no way should we have necessarily thought that. But then him going through the whole thing, shooting the shit out of the cop for no reason, really being the guy that is, in a lot of ways, was trying to solve the problem of the scene. You just see him become this huge character all of a sudden, very fast, with a ton of fucking emotion. And, you know, I'm sure there are plenty of guys that could do it. He wouldn't have even been on my list of a guy that could pull this off, right? And then in the moment, it's just like, fuck, he was made to do this.
Yeah, he crushed, man. Like, and it's just weird to see him, watching this again and then having seen all the movies that he's been in since. And he's like, man, he's been nowhere near this role since then. And not to say that he's going to play, you know, play this character the rest of his career, but like, shit, you know, think about him in Rush Hour. You know, he was like trying to do the drug deal at the beginning but he was buying some explosives or selling explosives to Chris Tucker. And then him in like Starsky and Hutch, right, where he's like the wise-ass cop giving Ben Stiller – you know, he's Manetti. He's the worst cop on the force. You know, it's like,
yeah, right.
You know, scenes like the or characters like that. It's like, shit, dude, I wouldn't mind. I mean, hell, he could have gotten, you know, a Nice Guy Eddie spinoff. And I know this wasn't the time, you know, 92, we weren't getting a bunch of spinoffs and shows like we are now because, well, the idea, I'm going to just say the idea pod is running dry. And so instead of getting, you know, a bunch of original stuff, we're just getting sequels and prequels and spinoffs or whatever. But I'm not gonna lie.
In a weird way, like the late 80s, early 90s were kind of a weird, definitely not like today where everything is just franchise, but
right.
There weren't people coming up with fresh ideas like this either. You know what I mean? Like it was just a weird time. And you know, in a lot of ways, like it probably sounds a little grandiose in saying this, but like when Tarantino kind of saved movies back then, right? Because he kept putting out gritty shit. He put out stuff like this. He put out stuff like Pulp, and then everybody else started making movies like that again instead of these like, you know, big, like if we looked up the 1989 Best Picture winners, we would probably be pretty fucking sick.
Oh, dude. Like,
or not Best Picture winners, but the ones that made the most money. I'll look it up. You keep going. Yeah.
Top grossing movies. I bet it really is going to be something silly, right? It was going to be like, I don't want to say Last of the Mohicans or something because I know that's not going to be the case. But anyway, so, you know, watching, just seeing him cook again, we get Tarantino gets the best out of his actors, or I don't want to say he gets the most out of a little because these are all clearly very talented actors. But right. Man, like we're talking about with Chris Penn, like this is, to me, this is the best I've seen him do. You know, like this to me, right. You know, having Harvey Keitel, and I know that he had a long career and so prior to this, he was already a big deal. He got that role because of who he was, but to have a person like Harvey Keitel just carry a movie like this where there's just so many moving pieces and so many different things going on. I mean, you know, you're talking about a guy getting the most out of it. I don't think we get that, we have that many directors who could do something like this, do we?
Not with a project like this. I think there are other people who can maybe take something that's, you know, maybe a bit bigger and kind of have decent other things kind of surrounding, you know, the actor. Like maybe they can get some, you know, nicer set piece or just do some other location, some bigger things and kind of still bring it out of them and maybe kind of mask where they slip. But I mean, for Tarantino to take this thing as a gift, a movie with a budget of $1 million that's, you know, primarily in three locations, I think, are the only places that we see it, maybe more than that, but you know, not many. It's still less than 10. Yeah. And to get like a Harvey Keitel, like, hey, you know, there's just this small thing. There's not a whole lot really going on, but at the same time, there is, you know, again, like I said, Harvey Keitel he'd been Harvey Keitel. He was already phenomenal. He was already great. You know, it's like he needed some help with his acting, but to be able to learn how to channel what makes him so great and make that work in this thing that, like, it would have been very possible for Harvey Keitel to just charm the shit out of this. And he almost feels out of place. Like this movie is like so small and he's almost like too big of a star. Too like big. He's blind. Yeah. Like he's blinding you the whole time, but that just doesn't happen. He feels perfectly a part of this. Like you said, Cole, you could probably find someone else who could fit in, but you know, it's just hard to imagine anyone doing it better than this for, you know, just a lot of reasons with, you know, the emotion that he's able to bring, but also, again, to not just blind you with his star and you just can't really focus on anything else new, because the whole time you're just like, wow, Harvey Keitel is really going fucking crazy, which, like, he does. He does a phenomenal job, but it's such, like, a controlled, well-used version of a Harvey Keitel performance in a movie like this.
It really is, and it's almost just like, look, we just need you, Harvey, to remind people of who you are, and he just gets in his movie. Mm-hmm. He's like, okay, bet, I don't need a script, and so he just comes in this movie and he does all these things and he just crushes, man. It's weird to not have, you know, to have an actor like this and not have a bunch of history with them, and then come into a movie like this, and then we see him in Pulp, and it's like, man, who is this? Like, this was, yeah, seeing him in a role like this, and then seeing him in Pulp as the Wolf is like, it compelled me just to look up his catalog and be like, man, what the fuck? What the,
this
like,
guy rules. We actually, yeah.
Is this guy like? Is this Capone's real? What's going on here, dude? Like, this guy is he's just a beast, dude. But
you know, again, like, not to keep hashing out, but this is one of those moments where it's just like, it happens because Tarantino just learned how to make movies a different way and makes them from a perspective of someone who just makes, and I know, like, most directors love movies, but he genuinely just makes these from the perspective of a movie lover, right? Because I'm sure if you had, like, another, you know, more established, more by the books director, they would try to get a more, you know, by the books, a typical kind of way that you get this performance out of him to sell stuff and create ads. But Tarantino didn't do that, right? Like, he took it and was like, what's the version of a great Harvey Keitel performance that just fits in this movie? Not like, what's the one that, you know, it can already be visualizing trailers and promotions and what's going to make, you know, this guy at this magazine say this or that. Like, he's just like, how am I going to make this work? And he just doesn't. So I hate to keep harping on that point, but just, this is just one of those movies, like, every time I think about something good about it, I'm almost just like, if he would have gone to film school or some shit like that, he just wouldn't have done this. And it would have just been like a little bit worse. It's like just him learning how to do this and making his own style, his own way of doing this stuff, just makes all of his movies shine in just this incredible way. Like, even his more recent stuff, where he is a bit more industry, like, he's still making them like the guy who made the movie with the $1 million budget.
Right. And it shows that this is a guy, obviously, you know, just a movie lover, but Harvey Keitel, you know, he probably grew up watching some of his, you know, right, other stuff. He's like, you know what? I want you to show that this is, you can still do this thing. Not to say that he was like over the hill or anything like this, but it just seemed like this was written with Harvey in mind. Like, you know, a lot of times we hear about directors making a movie and it's like, before they even get somebody, he's like, okay, this is who I want to play, this particular character. And it just seemed like White was this. He was like, I had White and, you know, you in mind for playing Mr. White, and he made it happen, and it worked beautifully, dude. Like, he was so good. Like, when he, you know, all the scenes where he really had to stretch his legs, he did it. And at the end, like I say, he's showing all the emotionality. When he's showing that emotion, and dude, it was great. Like, the anger, the confusion, he was sad. He's like, you know, after Orange is like, listen, you know, he told him he's a cop, and he's like, look like we have to do a little bit of time. He's like, you can just see it in his eyes. He's like, nope. Not gonna happen. But this movie, I mean, it's just great, though, dude. Beginning to end,
we're talking about
it's just packed full of great content, and it's just an awesome movie, dude. Like, I really did have a difficult time with a couple of my categories, and it took actually my second watch to really be able to fill in the rest outside of my laugh out loud. And I know you guys already talked about yours at the beginning, but my particular laugh out loud was when Chris Penn was in a story about Lois and how, you know, she had a little shit bag of a husband, too. And he said she wacko glued his dick to his stomach, and the guy and White was like, was he pissed? And he's like, I don't know. You'd be pretty pissed too if you every time you have to pee, you had to do a fucking handstand. I think just the visual of somebody, and I know you said like the fire department had to come and, you know, help him out with that, but just the visual of somebody having to do a handstand just to pee because his dick was glued to his stomach is hilarious to me.
And before that, like in that same scene, he goes, like, he's like, no, that's not Pam Grier, that's the other one. And then he goes through the whole thing and she played him in the show. And he's like, well, then who played X? And he was like, how the fuck am I supposed to? Yeah, how the fuck am I supposed to know? And Steve Buscemi goes, well, now I'm really miffed.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, that's Pam Grier.
Well, like, yeah, no, that actually is a hilarious reaction. Like, you should know, actually. You just...
How the fuck am I supposed to know after you just went on this full, like, history of the show?
Yeah.
Right, like, full history of it. And then he's like, so who played this person? Like, I don't know. And then Tim Roth said some actress. And then that's when White was like, no, that's Honey White. You know, they're just, like, going back and forth. Just, like, like a bunch of nothingness, but the it all played into, like, that's how a story would go like that, where, you know, right. Chris Penn is trying to tell the story. And everybody is chiming in on a bunch of facts that have nothing to do with what he's actually talking about.
He said anybody that laid eyes on her had to jerk off at least once.
At least once. All right. So I know you guys talked about your – so that's your laugh out loud was that opening scene at the diner. Do you guys want to elaborate on that anymore?
But it's just like – it just catches you off guard. Like, you have an idea of what this movie is about, and you're going into it. And again, you maybe do think there's going to be more action. You're going to get something like the heist. And to just have the movie start off with that diner scene and, like, the eight most unserious people you've ever met, you're like, going to pull off this big heist. It's just funny. And, like, you know, and there's, like, just a bunch of moments in that just kind of make me laugh. And Mr. Blonde says he'll shoot White. And White goes, if you even shoot me in a dream, you better wake up and apologize.
You better wake up.
Sorry, man. Yeah. Some of the hardest shit we've ever put in a movie before. We don't make lines like that no more.
It's just deranged, like, to start a movie insane. Like that. It's his first movie, and he's like, this is what I'm fucking doing. That's insane. Like, that is truly insane. And situationally, it's why it's so funny, because, like Chris said, you're waiting to see the name of the movie is Reservoir Dogs, right? The poster looks like a murder documentary. Like, and then the first thing you get is dicks, and they're just talking about the dumbest shit at a diner. And then we go into the whole tip thing, man. It's like, it's so fucking surreal and funny. And again, like, just deranged. Who starts a movie like that?
I shouldn't hear the word dick that many times 3 minutes into a movie like that. That hasn't been done since.
Yeah. Maybe.
It's actually funny that you say dick less. Right. Don't even say
that. Honestly, yeah. Damn, the pizza guy at least gets to go inside the house first. Shit.
Yeah. It's like, he got to go in there and fix the leaky faucet.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny because in Desperado, whenever Tarantino is telling this story about how, you know, they're sitting at the bar waiting on Bucho to get the confirmation about him, and he's telling a story to Cheech, and he's like, hey, you want to hear a funny story? And he said, talking about the guy who was, like, trying to pee in the glass from across the bar. He's like, hey, I'll bet you $500 I can pee in that glass. And so he goes, and he's like, so the guy's like, he's focusing on the glass. He's like, dick glass. And again, he goes to pee, and he's peeing everywhere. He's peeing on the bar. He's peeing on the people. He's peeing on the store. He even peed on the bartender. And the bartender, after, he's like laughing his fucking ass off. He's like, ah. He's like, yeah, I need $500. He's like, wait 1 minute. Walks over to these guys. They talk, give them some money. And then he said, walk back over to him. And he's like, what are you laughing about? And he's like, well, before I came over here and bet you, I bet those guys that I could pee on your bar, pee on your stools, and even pee on you. And not only would you be not mad about it, you'd be happy.
I think you did that better than he did it.
Dude, that's pretty solid, man.
That's your movie now, actually. Yeah.
Dude, man. Dick glass. All right, so I touched on this already. Again, I feel like I've already, like, revealed all of my categories, but the Mr. Mustang went to Randy Brooks. He played Holdaway, who helped out Mr. White, who was undercover, helped Orange, who was undercover, but he also gave him the commode story, which we've talked about. So I thought he was really good in just helping Orange get set up with all of that, but then giving him a great anecdote to be able to disarm these guys and keep them off his scent, essentially. So that was mine. Chris, who was yours?
Oh, man, I hate to be the odd man out, but I went with Quentin Tarantino for mine. Just when he plays Brown, maybe he's in it too much, but, you know, when he kind of plays and he tells the story, that's pretty funny. When they have the meeting before the heist, he is just kind of like playing that. Well, it's weird because, like, you know it's him, And it's like such like a unintrusive performance by him. Like it's almost just impressive, right? Like he's not like overdoing it. He didn't write his, I mean, he wrote himself the Like a Virgin story. And I'm sure that was kind of fun, but he's like not in it. And like, you know, like he's not like so aggressively in it that it's throwing you off. That it's, you know, like he's so subtly in his own movie that it's just impressive to me. You know what I mean? Like, and of course, it's not like this is the first or the last time he's been in a movie of his. You know, that's like a thing that he does, and he's always able to just kind of squeeze himself in there in a capacity where he's not, it's not like a farce. Like, you know, he's still, you know, a part of the movie, but not so big of a part where it's distracting. But every time he does, you know, every time I see him do it, I just kind of enjoy it. And I think we've talked about this before. I like when directors would just pop in their own movies and just do a silly little just thing, you know. Something.
Yeah.
Alfred Hitchcock wouldn't let himself get on a bus one time. Like, come on, sure at least wouldn't. Let yourself get on the bus, man. So yeah. I really like that. As Brad, you know, he, like I said, he's got some funny stories and he's just so unintrusive in the movie that it's almost like good somehow. It's so normal that it's good, if that means anything.
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it's just funny, then he gets shot in the head. So then
he does, man. He said, I can't see. He's like, you got blood in your eyes.
He gets killed and all his stuff.
If I had a dollar.
Right, Cole, who'd you have, Mustang?
I went with Randy Brooks as well, Keith, mostly for the same reasons. He also just added a little bit of character to the movie.
Because it's full of characters, but
right,
he gave
it
the dynamic, right?
Right, and he was one of the few people in the movie that wasn't actually a major part of the movie, right? Like, there weren't a ton of characters that just popped in for a second. And he definitely was one of those, and you can definitely tell he was just a guy that Tarantino wanted to write about, like that sort of person, and put him in the movie and picked a perfect person to play him. So I went with Randy Brooks as well.
The outfit, when Tim Roth is kind of doing the walkthrough, doing his performance of the commode sword, the outfit that he has on, funniest shit I've ever seen. It's like
wild.
A crop top wild, vest, man, with like a tie-dye headband.
It makes no sense.
Worst fit I've ever seen, probably. But like,
yeah,
man,
it's
impressively bad.
Oh, what is going on here? All right, so James Winston, I went with, I actually went with Mr. Blonde. I didn't, for a guy who had just gotten out of prison and done 4 years, and he was just like so ready. I'm here to do a job, and bro didn't even like, he hadn't even gotten all his possessions back yet. He still had, like, missing his belt from prison. And then he's just like this trigger happy psycho who was just ready to shoot people because he's like, I told him I didn't like alarms, you know? And so just like, dude, calm down. And then he's gonna set this cop on fire before he even gets any information out of him. And he was too much of a wild card for me to be on a crew that was supposed to be, I guess, more precision and not so much just like, let's just go in there and just spray down the place and just figure out the rest. So Blonde was my Winston for the movie. What about you, Chris?
Same person. It's Mr. Blonde for a lot of the same reasons. You know, I don't know how, I'm sure the movie definitely goes differently if he doesn't die, but you know, there was almost maybe this idea that you could start to think that Harvey Keitel, Mr. White, is maybe the rat when he's talking like, oh, he's such a wild card, he was in there acting crazy, he was just doing anything. And it's like, okay, well, you know, like you said, he just got out of, you know, jail, so I can't imagine he just is just this insane guy who just shows, you know, no reserve, is unable to not do the dumb thing, and then not even 15 seconds after everyone leaves the safe house, he's like, I'm gonna cut your ear off and light you on fire. And they're like, oh, okay, yeah, he is just an insane person that would do all the terrible, you know what I mean? Like, you don't have any time to be on his side. I'm like, nah, this doesn't fit his motive, man. He gives you 30 seconds of being normal and he cuts a guy's ear off. So that's why Mr. Winston, then he gets shot for it. That's happening. You're not normal in a Quentin Tarantino movie. If you get a Quentin Tarantino movie, you refuse to be normal, you get shot.
Yep.
A lot of times, too.
A lot of times.
Yeah, shot a lot. All right, Cole, who you got?
Man, it might should be the Mr. Blonde Award because this is like iconic fuck-up performance, dude. Like, he just went batshit crazy and fucked the whole movie up, dude. Like, everything sideways in the aftermath was because of him. And it not only because Orange obviously is a very close second contender because he was undercover police officer, but correct, he was also just kind of doing his job. You know what I mean? And Blonde just fresh out of jail was just like, yep, I'm going to shoot a bunch of cops and cut one's ear off. Like, no, come on.
Right. and shoot a bunch of innocent.
I ain't people. Going back.
I ain't good. I ain't going back. All right. So Ferentz Due, I talked about him already. He's a nice guy, Eddie. But Chris Penn, man, I just thought he was really great in this role. And I hate that, again, I don't, you know, not a typecast scenario, but I just hate that we didn't get to see him kind of spread his legs more like this with the character and stretch his legs out as this character or something similar. I felt like he was really believable as this guy. Like with that scene at the end where he's defending Blonde and he's like, you know, talking about a guy who could have rolled on them at any point, never did. He's like, so why don't you just tell me what really happened? And he's like spitting and his face, his eyes are bulging out. That scene was great. So that was my rent too. Chris, who you got?
Man, I really wanted to give it to Harvey Keitel just because how much you talked about him. He is phenomenal. But I think I'm going to go in the spirit of the award before you kill me. I think I want to go with Tim Roth because he is just really good in this. And like,
he is good.
You know, for the sake of the award, Rent was due. I mean, Tim Roth was acting like he was down to his last pair of socks. Like he needed, you know, he needed to cash some kind of check. He needed to make something happen. He's phenomenal in this. Like, you know, like the accent.
And then a couple times he goes for it.
Yeah, he really does. And it's like, and it works.
Dying.
Yeah. Dying.
Yeah, he definitely has the traditional of let it fly. I'm not getting another movie part.
And that's like what I'm thinking, like to start off the movie. Like, I mean, I know he's at, you know, he's at the in the diner scene, but you know, for his first real big thing to do in the movie is to just start off in the back of the car crying and dying and screaming to just have to just take off like that and then, you know, work out the rest of the movie. I thought it was just really cool, and I thought he did a great job. And again, you know, in the spirit of the award, he has kind of parlayed into having a pretty nice career. I mean, Tarantino called him back for like the fucking next thing he did after this, so that's going to be mine. Again, I think that Harvey Keitel's performance is like probably just a little bit better, but you know, it's almost unfair because he's Harvey fucking Keitel. But I just want to say, like, you know, Tim Roth was just kind of this guy who, you know, made the most out of this opportunity. For as much as we talk about this movie being kind of small and having to just find a way to work, I think he was like the perfect guy to also take advantage of this opportunity.
Absolutely. He definitely parlayed this into, well, just being in every Tarantino movie from now on, from then on.
His
but
that whole flashback sequence, he's just like, he's really good at. Like, and every time I watch it, like, I know he's not using his regular accent, but every time I hear it, I'm just like, if I watch this enough, I'll forget that Tim Roth is like British or something, because that accent is like, it's pretty good. Like he's pretty convincing. He just plays that character really well. So,
agreed. Who'd you have, Cole?
It's Tarantino, guys. I mean, $1 million budget, first movie, and completely made one of the movies that people talk about the most. Destroyed Sundance, completely changed the way that we experience like movie festivals, set up a career that would, you know, very much be the one that everybody looks to as far as somebody coming up making movies and being a creative director. And like y'all were talking about, with all of these great performances in this movie, we didn't see other people get performances out of these guys like Quentin Tarantino did. And when he is in the movies, he was great. Like Tim Roth at his fucking best in Hateful Eight, like Harvey Keitel at his fucking best in Pulp Fiction, Michael Madsen, all these guys, he just has a way of making them be the best that they can be. And just being able to pull this movie off, one we've talked about already, but just he's that guy. You know what I mean? Like, he made it work. It's got to be Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, that's fair. I can't argue with it. So before I get to the best scene, I want to introduce the category that I thought of during this movie, but it was the, I'm going to call it the Eddie Bunker Award, because he played Mr. Blue. What's the purpose of this guy award? What did Mr. Blue do in this whole movie?
Mr. Blue got the iconic line of, what's exceptional? She takes you in the back and sucks your dick.
Sometimes
that's what Mr. Blue gets.
Like that.
Yeah. So I will say, I'm with you. Why is this guy in the movie? It's got to be for we're going to keep this award. It may not be every episode, but somebody that isn't super important in the movie has to have a fucking fire ass line. Like, what, she take you in the back and suck your dick?
What was the line? God. Oh, what was the line in, dang it, not the Michael Douglas, Sharon Stone.
There's a line. Basic Instinct.
Basic Instinct. God, there was a line that his buddy said right before that like after he was at the diner.
Oh my God. Oh my God. You're right.
What was that line that we were talking about?
Rip my head off.
What did he say, man?
That's gonna bug the shit out of me because we
man, I'm so close. I'm pissed off. Like I know, like I'm so close, and I'm mad now. Crying about that.
Because it made like that line made no fucking sense.
Was it about a Rolex? Something was said about a watch or something.
I know, but like outside of the
watch that whole fucking movie tonight.
There was also that iconic there are cum stains all over the sheets. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, she got that Magnum Culotte pussy on her that says right up your brain.
That's what it is.
Yeah, Basic Instinct, man. It's got quite a few of them.
Yes. Yeah, there needs to be just the one character who doesn't do anything else.
Oh, shit.
But because like that line is it's too hot for the main character to say, so there has to be just like that one throwaway person who doesn't show for the rest of the movie.
Right. Yeah, and die. That
thing. Yeah, right, yeah. Or gets transferred to another department shortly thereafter. We don't see him again. But anyway, yeah. So the Eddie Bunker, what was the purpose of this guy award? I just wanted to introduce that. But so I've already talked about it, but the leading up to and then the telling of the commode story was just awesome. And then of course the scene itself was great. Like all of it was amazing. So that was my best scene. Here's what you got.
Man, I don't know how often we do this, but it's a rare moment where my best scene and my laugh out loud scene are the same scene. That diner scene is just great, man. Like, I know we go on to get additional character scenes or character backstories from the other guys, but that is also just a great way to catch you off guard, introduce you to these personalities in like a very like light sense, see how they all bounce off each other. And it gives you some stuff about them, but you still don't know a lot. Because, again, you don't know if this is their first job together. You don't know if they've even discussed, what the job's going to be. You don't know if they're all friends. You don't really know much about, you get something that feels like a bit of insight. You're like, oh, they have known each other for a little bit longer. But then you run into something just like, maybe they don't know each other. I mean, you just kind of go back and forth. Like, it does do a good job of what I think they're supposed to be doing is keeping it kind of ambiguous, not letting each other know too much about them by using the code names or whatever. And it kind of keeps you at that distance as well with these guys. Like, it lets you in just enough to know about them, but you still don't end up ultimately knowing them until kind of later on. And it's just funny, and I think it has a lot to do with the fact that it does just catch you off guard. But it is just like well-written scene that just throws you right into the type of dialogue and the type of character work that Quentin Tarantino is going to be capable of for his entire career. And I really love that scene. I know there's probably some other stuff in there that is just phenomenal that blows it out of the water, but that is just one that I'm just like just stuck on, because again, shouldn't work. No one else would do it, and if someone else did, it would be bad.
Right, and like you're talking about, Chris, it gives that group dynamic, and we can see, okay, Joe is clearly the leader, the organizer of this group or whatever, because people are ultimately like they're listening to him more than anybody else. But then we just get to see it is fun, at least for me, to try to piece together where this particular scene falls in the timeline that is this movie. Right? Is it the morning of the heist, or is it what are they about to go do? So anyway, so there's several scenes where I try to put, okay, where does this actually fall in the timeline of this particular movie? Cole, what'd you have best scene?
Man, I think this one was pretty difficult because like there aren't really scenes in this movie. They're just extended sequences. But I went with the one right after, they got back, Mr. White, Mr. Orange got back, and then Mr. Pink showed up. Buscemi and Harvey Keitel just going at it for a bit was just fucking iconic, man. Like, both of those guys, and we haven't even talked nearly enough about how good Buscemi was in this.
Yeah.
It's like, he kind of was like nailed his shit too. But that just banter back and forth between them, trying to figure out what's going on, trying to find the mole, all of that sort of stuff, man, is just captivating shit.
Yeah, it was really good. But Jimmy, I mean, when he came in, he was just like, well, that was a fucking, he was hyped from the jump, dude.
He was throwing 100 miles an hour right off the bat.
He really was. He just ran in there and was ready to work. So on the award side of it, Cole, did you see anything?
Man, no noms, which is kind of a travesty when you think about it. Like, especially like screenplay stuff, you know, almost always his stuff gets something screenplay wise. So it is kind of curious.
Yeah, it is weird. Well, and I think this was early in the, you know, early on in the Academy days. And so the Oscars only went to, you know, like a major transformation, somebody planned, you know, Winston Churchill or something, and not for actually like, oh, this is just a good performance. It had to be something like that or something sexy. This wasn't sexy enough, I don't think.
It was also the Unforgiven year, you know, so it was like a lot of really good movies came out. Yeah.
That's tough.
Yeah, you don't want to go up against Unforgiven.
Yeah, that'll do it. That'll keep you at home on that faithful Sunday in March.
Well, you don't want to be the fella running that shithole, so I get it.
Yep. Who's the fella that runs this shithole?
Who's the fella that runs this shithole? So trivia wise, I talked about mine already, but the budget was low, and so a lot of these actors, like Cole said, brought their own wardrobes, or there wasn't, you know, the budget wouldn't cover police assistance. So the scene where he forced a woman out of the car, he could only do it when the traffic lights were green. That's incredible, and it's still pulled it off. So it does seem like there's a lot of people in the background or of that particular scene or on the sidewalk that genuinely are looking like, what the fuck just is confused. Going on?
You know, like, when he's running through the street. Yeah.
So confused. There weren't many cameras out there, and so I think a lot of them were just like, okay, what's actually happening? Is this person actually getting carjacked or what? You guys find any other trivia?
Yeah, most of it was just like you were talking about, like what they had to make work with a low budget, right, which is awesome, but right, I didn't see a lot of super curious stuff.
Same.
Outside of, like, I'd heard an interview with Quentin Tarantino a few years later, and at the same time, like, he had actually, so Tony Scott ended up being, you know, one of our guys, ended up being friends with Quentin Tarantino, and Tarantino sent both scripts to Tony Scott. Those two scripts were Reservoir Dogs and True Romance, and Tony Scott wanted to make Reservoir Dogs, but Tarantino said he wanted to do it himself, so he said, all right, cool, I'll make True Romance. Like, can you imagine liking a guy and thinking he is that good that much to where you're just like, cool, I'll make this movie?
Yeah.
And the rest is history.
Yep.
All right, Joseph, that is Reservoir Dogs. You can find that on HBO Max. I don't know for how long, because stuff just gets, seemingly as soon as I get settled into something, it gets yanked, and then we get
turn off while you're in the middle of it.
That's great. Austin Powers back on for another 6 months.
Yep. But not the first one.
Yeah.
It's only shit like that makes me
just
mad.
Just gold member.
Yeah. Legit. All right, so Chris is back to you.
Yes.
Yeah. Uh-oh.
Guys, you're gonna be a little mad at me. We have to do it. We have to get it over with. No, I'm mentally sane, Beaver. I'm still fine. We have to do it now. We have to get it over with so you can get all these done by the time the next one comes out in the summer. We're gonna go to Paramount Plus. We're gonna put on our big boy pants. We're going to watch Mission Impossible 2, and then we don't have to think about it anymore.
Oh,
then,
no.
We don't ever have to think about it ever again, dude. We just got to watch it. We can figure out why this one is bad compared to all the other ones, and then we can move on. I will call Paramount Plus and ask them to remove it so you don't even have to worry about seeing it anymore. I can make that call. I've got one freebie in the books. Yeah, I haven't used my one freebie yet. I got this in the books.
I'm in, so, dude. Yeah. Let's go. John Woo.
You can do it, Keith. I believe in you. You can just watch this one once. You don't have to
watch it again. I can tell you, I can tell you why it's not like one of these is not like the others.
Yeah.
No,
seen the Rotten Tomatoes? I'm going to find those, like, when Fallout came out, Rotten Tomatoes had like a chart of like when movies have like a series. It's like the bar graph that's just kind of going up and down, just showing like all the ratings or whatever. And it's like one, it goes like all the way down the hill for two, and then it's just like up the resurrected rest of them. And I'm going to find it. It's the funniest shit I've ever seen. The graphic is hilarious, dude. Like, it doesn't even look like it belongs in this franchise. You almost think, like, did they put the wrong movie here? Because why is this one so low compared to literally every other one? So,
yeah.
Chris, it's a funny visual. I applaud your bravery for picking this, because I was just
I knew no one else was.
I was gonna skip it and go 3, 4, 5, 6. So
but you know what, dude? I kind of like the balls, man. I kind of like the ball. He was like, "Fuck it, we're doing it."
There's no one who can do it but us.
Dick.
Dick glass.
Yeah, no one can do this but us, man. We have just figured out what was wrong with it. And I know we probably already know, but it'd be nice to talk about it on the pod and just, you know, these are the things that I love to do on the pod. Like, we mostly do good movies, but every now and then I'm glad we're all around on something that isn't as great as what our tastes normally have us diving into, just to be like, what was going on here, actually? So I'm very, very excited.
Yeah, not every movie's got to be a banger, you know?
Right.
Keith once made us do Fear.
Man, I was thinking about that like 10 minutes ago. We were talking. I can't remember what we were talking about. And I just randomly thought, I was like, well, that one time we did Fear.
Yeah. So glad we did.
Love it. Oh, it was a fun time. Abraham Lincoln was there and shit. It was crazy.
It was the beginning of rants on every pod, as far as like we call that guy Methuselah.
Keith called that guy Methuselah, dude.
He was old, man.
He was old. He's supposed to be what, like 22?
Yeah.
Even Casey Affleck was like, shit, dude, I don't know about that one.
He's like, I don't know if this one's viable.
Yeah, yeah.
43-year-old Casey Affleck.
Like, bro, you're supposed to be 19 in this movie. You're 32 when we filmed it. All right, everybody. So we have our marching orders. We are going to go to Paramount Plus, Mission Impossible 2.
It sounds funny. Come on, just saying it.
I was like, just keep saying it, dude. It's hilarious. Because I know how much you hate this one, dude. It's like, I hate to do
man,
it.
Man, I don't even. I have all of the DVDs, literally, except for 2. I purposefully.
That is pretty messed up.
I'm sorry, man. What do you hate more? Mission Impossible 2, Friends, or Unthawed?
Unthawed's 1. I don't know about Friends, dude. Friends and Mission Impossible 2 might be neck and neck.
They're
battling it out.
That's a tough ask, man. It's like, what do I hate the most?
Keith almost fired a kid for saying Unthawed at work one time. It was crazy.
What do you hate most? Hitler.
Hemorrhoids David or
Duke
Hitler?
Or I'm sorry,
man. We will overcome.
I will put on watch this movie. Yeah, no, I'm not gonna shit on it for the entire pod. We're gonna watch this with clear eyes and a full.
He wears
heart.
A cool jacket. Sometimes that's what the movie's all about. Does a character wear a cool jacket?
Rides a motorcycle. Yeah. That's cool.
He has Let's go. Long hair. Dude, that's
the hierarchy of needs. Does the character wear a cool jacket? If that one's met, that's fine. You know what I mean? Yeah. You don't have to eat that day. Watch a movie with a guy in a cool jacket.
It's true. It's
3,000 calories on its own. That's too many.
Jackets won Mr. Mustang at least twice.
That is true. See?
Yeah, at least twice. Yeah.
We're going to make it, Keith.
The harder they fall, it got because of the red leather jacket.
Oh, yeah.
I'd do anything for that jacket.
When Thandi Newton walks up to, when she gets back to her ex-boyfriend and he walks up to her, she has a scarf. Like, John Woo had a slow-mo scarf catch. I just wanted to get this
that
out now
right.
Because
I
have to speak positively to – anyway. So, yes, everybody has their marching order. It is Reservoir Dogs on Netflix, and then we're going to Paramount Plus, Mission Impossible 2. We're going to go through all of them. So whenever we get the rest, we're going to get to Rogue Nation, and we're going to talk. That's going to be a 4-hour.
Oh, yeah.
It's okay.
It's going to be tough. It's okay.
Good of a movie for a normal length pod. Streets will understand.
We're just going to talk Henry Cavill 4 hours. All right, so for all of us here at the stream team, Keith Evans, Cole Miller, Chris Lowry. Dick Glass.